form. That's cool.
There you go. So you just put it in there. So you have to, like, kind of unscrew it.
Where'd you get that little tripod?
I don't know. I had it. I don't know, for some damn thing, you know.
It's excellent.
Like I said last time, I've collected so much, like, yeah.
I hate that damn side button. Yeah. Every time I hit that button is by accident.
Yeah.
Almost every single time I hit that button is by accident.
But I'm sorry, you were
so Mike Booty. We're here at Davenport's Pizza.
Yes, in the stadium.
And we're talking about the relative benefits of Substack.
Yeah.
Versus other social media.
Yeah. So I'll tell you something about Davenport's is that it was. This is not the original location. The original location is about 5 minutes down the road.
Yep.
In Mount Brook Village. And I believe it was originally owned by a baseball player named Jim Davenport.
Oh, yeah. I think
I don't know anything else about him.
I think I read something about that.
Yeah. But it's pretty good pizza. It's, like, generally agreed on. It's, like, to me, it's, like, the best pizza in Birmingham.
Yeah. That's excellent. One thing they've got going for them is the red candles, the red glass with real candle inside. They've got the red and white tablecloths, the red booths,
and they've got the arcade machines in there from, like, the 1980s and 70s.
Yeah.
And so all that the kids are playing.
I mean, I really appreciate, you know, I like it already just for those factors.
It's like the very traditional, like, you know, 1980s pizza parlor.
Yeah.
You know? And people love it. Yeah, this place opened up about 2 years ago, I think.
You ever watch any of those pizza reviews, like Dave Portnoy pizza reviews?
Nuh-uh.
The algorithm fed me one on YouTube.
Okay.
And I watched one, and it must have been one of the best ones because the owner of the place came out and started yelling at him and saying, "I don't really appreciate what you do, man."
Was he talking bad about the pizza?
He hadn't even reviewed it yet. You know, this guy just came out, and he's wearing, like, this really too tight Star Wars shirt that was really old and tucked into his pants, and had a big beer belly, the guy that owned the restaurant. And it was just so funny, you know, because he just came out, and he's just like, "Yo, man, I really don't appreciate what you do."
So he knew he was there to review his pizza from watching the YouTube videos?
He was like, "You come around, and you take a bite of my pizza, of people's pizza, and then you review it." And, you know...
Does he just take the pizza off the people's table?
No, he orders a pizza.
Uh-huh.
And he goes out in front of the restaurant.
Okay.
Stands in front of the door.
Okay, with, like, a tripod open.
Opens it and takes... He's got a cameraman. Takes a bite. And then he rates it, you know?
So rates it based on one bite?
Yeah, pretty much.
So he's basically just a reviewer and...
Yeah.
Well, that's okay.
It's
especially if he's not filming, like, in the actual... He probably opens the door and, like, does it outside just so...
Yeah.
You know, it's public property, I guess, so you can't get in trouble for it, right? You know?
But, let's see, what were we talking about right before we hit record?
So you were telling me about the origins of space.
Ah! That's right.
Yeah.
Gosh, right when I graduated, 98 must have been, I got a job at a cell phone store.
Right.
And it was called, I don't even remember what it was called, Intercell, because I called it Intercell.
Intercell.
Now, it's the company that started a company called PowerTel.
Okay.
And they brought GPS phones to North America. Am I saying it right? The ones that had the GSM.
Like the satellite phones?
No, not they were the first GSM phone system.
Okay.
It was like the little feature phones that had like snake games.
Snake, yeah.
Built
yeah.
into them, and you could could text people back and forth.
Yeah,
and
I had my first phone. You could play Snake on it. I did not text anybody until my second phone came along. I probably owned a PowerTel phone. I know that I had a Motorola phone that my sisters and I had to share, like, in 1995
Oh, that sounds wonderful.
Or whatever, because, you know, it was basically just a phone that we could use to, like, call our dad when, like, an after-school activity was over.
Oh, yeah.
So if you had the after-school activity that day, you had
the
phone.
Oh, I see.
And so we all got involved in after-school activities so that we could all have the phone, you know, because we thought it was really cool. Anyway, I'm sorry.
No.
So space.
Intercell was a... The store manager was a guy named Darren Lacombe.
Yeah.
And he hated me.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. I wrote surreal messages on like receipts.
Yeah.
I was just a weird kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, oh, and I always put the calculator on the counter. And for some reason, he had this damn thing about the calculators being on the counter. He couldn't stand it, you know?
Sounds like a very OCD guy.
Yeah, he was a huge Kiss fan. So he was always ordering things in the mail, like these collectible Kiss dolls. And, you know, his merchandise was always showing up at the store. And he was, like, always going in his office to, like, salivate over whatever new Kiss merchandise he had ordered, you know.
What year was this? Like 1990?
98.
So? 98. So it was that late. Okay.
Now, I am old enough.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
My first job with cell phones was in Sears Brand Central.
Oh, wow.
I was in Division 3. We sold the cell phones, cordless telephones, regular telephones, typewriters, computers, fax machines, PDAs. Yeah.
PDAs, yeah.
This was 1990 and 91.
Okay.
I started college in 89.
I didn't know that PDAs were around that early.
Yeah, the Sharp PDAs had come out.
Okay, wow.
And basically, you know, you'd have 32K to put all your phone numbers in. And, you know, it's spell checker and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And we sold those little, like, spell check gadgets, Bibles in a box where you have, like, one little LCD screen that you could read the Bible on.
Yeah.
But, you know, you could sell them to people because they could come in and you would say, hey, check this out. I'll type a word in and you can see how many times that word appears in the New Testament. You know, wild stuff like that, right? Which it demonstrated well.
Yeah, sure.
So
yeah.
People would chunk down $120 and buy it as a Christmas gift for grandma.
$120, that's not bad.
Yeah.
To basically have a word searcher for the Bible.
But Sears was a wonderful place back then. Sears Brand Central was right when they started selling name brand electronics.
Right.
And merchandise. So every single product they represented, they were the number one retailer in America.
Yeah.
So we sold the IBM PS1 computer. We sold Packard Bell computers. I remember the 386 had just come out. $2,000 for the CPU alone. You had to buy the monitor separate.
Oh my God, really?
Yeah.
I had the one of those Radio Shack computers. That was my first computer, one of those TI 80, 81s, whatever they sold. We went to Radio Shack in the mall and got a computer.
Like the Radio Shack version of the TRS-80?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah. Well, oh, I'm talking about the TI, that's Texas Instruments.
Yeah.
What was the one I had? It was whatever they used to call the Trash 80 or whatever.
Oh, yeah,
sort of in that vein.
I think Radio Shack had their own version of
they
that.
They did, yeah.
You know, later in life, I worked for the marketing, a studio called Circle R Media.
Yeah.
That was in the Radio Shack headquarters in Fort Worth.
Uh-huh. Oh, really?
Yeah. And the coolest thing we did is we did all the, this was right after Funimation.
Yeah.
We did all of the stuff they showed on the monitors at GameStops across the country.
Yeah.
Because GameStops were out there in Dallas.
Right.
So we were just there. Yeah. They were really in between Dallas and Fort Worth.
Yeah.
And we were in Fort Worth. So. So we had been spun off from Radio Shack as an independent company.
Right.
And had this incredible studio, probably the nicest studios in the Southeast at the time. We did motion capture for video game companies. They would hire actors and come in.
That's cool. So, Tandy computer, that's what I was thinking.
The Tandy, 1988.
Yeah.
So it's an XT clone.
Yeah.
But it did have the smaller floppy drive, which is cool.
It did have a floppy drive. We had like a whole thing of floppy, like a Rolodex of floppy disks.
Do you remember if it had a hard drive on it?
I know it did because I wrote a novel on it in the seventh grade.
Oh my gosh.
And you could only write 3 pages at a time.
Are you going to read this novel on your podcast?
No, God, no.
Hey, man. Yeah.
Thanks, man. I appreciate
Pete's,
it.
Pete's.
Nice. Look at that. Thank you. All right.
Oh, thank you.
I don't even know where that monitor is. My mom says she has it somewhere. But yeah, you would only write like about 3 pages of it before you had to like print it out and then erase it and start over again. So
I'm not understanding some. Oh, it's little pieces. Okay.
Yeah, little pieces.
Okay.
Yeah, there you go.
I felt like I was losing my mind.
Silverware, they get a silverware.
Oh, that's a problem.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll swing back by.
This is so silly because I'm starting my vlog tonight, so I'm going to film some video as well, if that's okay with you.
Oh, yeah, man.
I don't know how I'm going to do that because you took my tripod, but that's okay. I brought it for you to use that for.
Right. Well, that candle's not burning, so.
Yeah, no, we could probably put it there.
Yeah.
Here. Let's like move the salt and pepper shakers.
There we go.
All that. We're filming two ways.
And you have a wider lens.
I think that's pretty good. Do I have a wider? I don't know. Let's see if I can do that. I don't know. I think that's it. I'm always against people filming things in restaurants, but.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's fine.
That kind of works pretty
there
well.
We go.
You put that sort of off to the side and everything.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sort of good. I'm sort of just planning on doing narration over this, so it's okay.
Yeah, it's good. The Davenport's Pizza Review.
Exactly.
They cut it in really.
It's a very clean tablecloth.
They cut it in really small slices.
I know. It's almost like kind of being a kid.
I don't know if that's part of Chicago style or.
No, that'd be like deep dish. I don't know what it is, but it's a really good thing because you pay less and you kind of feel like you get more of it. You know? But I do need some silverware.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, I really like it.
No.
Yeah, get a lot of it.
Yeah, definitely. So the I don't know. We've gone on so many tangents now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you pass me a napkin, please?
Oh, yeah. Do I have all the napkins?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm all about tangents. That's pretty much my whole deal.
I know. Yeah, we went on so many tangents on that excerpt right the other day. I wish you could have been there for the whole time.
Yeah,
sometimes I'll listen to like them. Like, I'll listen back to them, you know, and... I hate to say this just to see if anybody talks about me because, like, I felt like when I left the room the other day because, like, I had just finished talking. Like, it got into sort of the whole thing where it's like I was sort of telling them, you know, teaching stories and kind of what it's like to teach now and everything. And I don't remember how it got around to that. I probably forced the issue. It was everything I sort of looked at. I look at the world these days and like the context through the lens of teaching students.
Well, I think people are really interested.
Yeah.
I remember when I was on there, everybody was really curious how it was teaching kids these days, you know, trying to think about differences.
Yeah, people are interested, yeah. But I feel bad. I felt like I monopolized about an hour of the thing.
Yeah.
Talking about it.
Well, you know, I talk a lot.
Yeah.
And I talk kind of loud.
Yeah.
Which my Laura reminds me. And I'm always, I say, well, you know, I can't really hear. So I'm kind of like David Lynch's character in Twin Peaks.
Yeah. I think that's fine. It's like my wife and I talk about the same volume. The problem is we just talk over each other.
Well, at least I'm glad she's talkative. I mean, that's a blessing.
But, yeah, the other day, it's like I had to leave because I had to go tutor a student. And I sort of just said, like, bye. And I kind of feel like as soon as I turned it off, like, I just felt like everybody was like, God, what a wacko.
Yeah.
I don't think they would have done that because, like, it's being recorded. But I was like, I've never done this before. I messaged Frank afterwards.
Yeah.
And I told him, like, I am so sorry. I really do feel like I just, like, took over the whole thing. And,
It didn't seem like you did, though, from what I heard.
Okay, so I just think I have like a general kind of fifth sense to feel bad that I'm over talking, you know. But it's a teaching thing though, because like you're used to as a teacher being the most talkative person in the room.
Yeah.
And sometimes your students just never ever give you feedback on whether or not you're saying too much to them. Huh. So you know, I just sometimes don't know. So.
You know, radio is would be the same way, because if you were like doing a lot of talking on radio, you know, if you stop talking, there's nothing there, right?
No.
And if the people around you, hey man, can we get some silverware?
Oh yeah, I got it. Thank you. Yeah, you're right about that, and that's why it's like I love. You know, radio so much, and I love like radio personalities like Phil Hendry. And
oh man,
I just love talk shows because I you know, just love the ability of like, you know, broadcasters to be able to sort of like hold, to sustain, to know exactly when to pause.
Yeah,
you know, because I just said something and I want you to think about that before I say the next thing,
right?
And I just, it's such an art form, and something that is like genuinely being lost, I feel. Some silverware right here.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Can I get you guys anything else in the meantime?
I think we're good.
Hey,
your name, I'm sorry, Finn? Is that right? How do you spell that?
F-I-N-N.
F-I-N-N, okay, I thought so. I was interested, it's a name that I'm starting to hear like a lot more.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Do you get that?
Not quite. Not
the
quite.
Finn Wolfhart.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. People call you that. Yeah, it's a very common name. Anyway, all right, thanks. Just give me two forks.
He's like, why is that boomer fucking with me?
This is like a Hunger Games scenario. It's like you give, or maybe a team building, you give one person two forks and the other person two knives.
Ooh.
Seems like something they would have done in like the Boy Scouts. Yeah.
Or those trick questions Google would ask people.
Yeah. Anyway. But. Yeah, but it's like a, you know, with like going away of, you know, traditional radio and talk shows where it's like you don't even have to be a broadcaster anymore. You just have to be like a guy with a bunch of opinions, you know, and all that. And
it's true.
Even like podcasts, like I just get sad that like, you know, not, you know. That's one of the reasons I really like Bill Burr a lot. I don't listen to his podcast all the time, but Bill Burr, the comedian, may occasionally have a guest on, but most of the time it's just him talking. And I love that so much because it's like so many podcasts now, they think that they have to have a room full of people, a room full of their friends in order to have an interesting, you know, conversation. So,
yeah.
You know. And
there's room to breathe, too.
Yeah.
Like, I'm probably not good at that on radio, but, you know, I like that.
Your thing is that you're just weird.
I've heard that before.
It's like, your segments for the Overnight Escape Central were just like a freaking weird roller coaster of insanity and absurdity.
Wow.
They were fun to listen to. I'm not going to deny that at all. It's just like, I'm really trying to unravel this whole yarn that you've got away. But,
yeah.
They're fun though. I mean, I've always enjoyed listening to them, you know. My fondest memories are when I used to drive around delivering papers.
Mm hmm.
Listening to the Overnight Escape Central every week.
Oh, cool.
And,
is this a Diet Coke?
Yes, sir.
You know, just listening to, whenever PQ would announce your name, and I was like, oh my god. You know, because it would just turn into like a very I don't know, it would just like make the entire night, because your segments would usually last about as long as I needed to drive.
Thank you.
You guys enjoying everything so far?
We are.
Oh, yeah, man.
It. Appreciate
good
it. Yeah, they would just kind of make like the entire night sort of like a very interesting excursion and like absurdity.
Thanks. Yeah,
I just don't know where you're going. I don't know where you're coming from sometimes, but I mean, you know, that's fine. You know, I think that's fine.
Yeah, I try to whatever it is to honestly have an opinion, whatever that opinion is.
Yeah.
And try not to waffle on any sort of worries about the validity of the point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Like I always admired that about DJs that I looked up to.
Yeah.
How they would have a certain authoritative ownership of what they were saying.
Right.
So that it never seemed like they were worried about what they were saying or what you would think about what they were saying. Even if it was insane.
Yeah.
You
it's
know,
more about just sort of having like that kind of voice, you know, that just sort of like, you know, that tone, you know, I suppose.
That tone gets me in trouble.
Well, just setting, I mean, what I mean is like just setting kind of like, you know, it's like you listen to like a lot of old time radio and it's not necessarily like what they're saying, it's just the fact that they're there.
Yeah.
And it's kind of this like white noise companion, you know, kind of.
That's true.
Not to say what you're saying is white noise, but, you know.
Well, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was that. It's like a kind of an authorship that like old media always had. Even old Letterman, you know. There's something about his tone on late night David Letterman and before that the Letterman Show.
Yeah.
Where he's a showman. He knows he's the leader of what's going on, and he's the leader of the playground at that moment. And he's conducting this thing, and he's trying to put on a good show within the framework of, like, classically what a good show is in broadcasting up to that point.
Yeah, exactly. He's sort of like, I'm doing a monologue, these are my guests, but that's the format. Within that format, I'm sort of breaking things up a little bit.
Right.
And, And that's what Conan did also, you know, and just, you know, and it's so funny, you know, because by the time they sort of had that third wave of talk show hosts, late night talk show hosts, they sort of had figured it out to the point where it was no longer dangerous and no longer interesting at all, you know.
I can't think of anyone more unfunny than like Jimmy Fallon.
Yeah.
Or Stephen Colbert.
Yeah. The thing is,
his whole thing is he will literally come on and say, isn't Donald Trump a fart noise?
I know.
And the audience roars with laughter.
I know. And
is that it? Is that all you got, really?
I used to love Stephen Colbert so much when he was on Comedy Central.
As a guest.
As a guest, but also he was doing a send-up of everything. I mean,
was funny.
He was looking at it through the lens of, like, this is, like...
When he was the ridiculous conservative...
Exactly. He
show
was
host.
Doing a great character. And it was fun to see that, and he was using satire to make his point, but now it just comes across as pandering, you know?
Right.
It's like, this is what my audience wants to hear, and this is... I'm going to just tell you what you want to hear, you know? So... Yeah. It's not going to require like any thought whatsoever from you.
It's sad that whole era of television is really just gone. I mean, you know, I guess it's not really sad. It's just...
Well, it's just like...
What it is.
You know, yeah. It's so funny, you know, because the other night my friend Dave and I were watching Life with Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
Which was the last show that Lucille Ball made before she died. So, you know, it's like in the 1980s and her granddaughter, you know, she's moving in with her daughter and husband and the two kids, and her granddaughter on that show is played by Jenny Lewis, who's like a big singer now, you know. He's like one of my favorite singers actually right now. But you know, that was like when she was like 7 years old. But you know, it's funny because like there's Lucille Ball.
Yeah.
She's not resting on her laurels. You can tell she's actually trying.
Right.
And there's sight gags on the show. Like the first, the episode that we watched was like she is helping. She's working in a hardware store for the day because like Mr. Mooney or whatever his name is can't find any help. So she comes along and she kind of screws everything up. And, you know, she turns on like this, some kind of like a carpet shampoo machine. And she like, you know, and it starts spitting out suds and it like, you know, floods the entire shop in suds, and
yeah.
She's in the suds, and he's in the suds, and the kids, and it's meant to sort of evoke the classic I Love Lucy sight gags, like
right.
the grapes, you know, stomping around and wine yeah. bat and things like that. But it's just not funny, and the reason it's not funny is because, like, she's 80 years old, and that has been done, and that's been one-upped by comedians like Carol Burnett and Mary right. Tyler Moore. And it's just that era that she is living in is now over.
Right.
And we all see it. And it's one of those things where it's like we are so glad that we're not living in that era anymore because you can't just make that joke forever.
Right.
And
yeah.
it's one of those shows that, oddly enough, I'm like glad that I saw because it was so awful. And you do feel bad for Lucille Ball in it. You feel bad for anybody who was involved in that show.
Right.
But. You know, you're sort of like, you're thankful for it because she's coming along to kind of remind you that, like, wasn't it great that you lived through a time where you were at least aware of when I was funny? You know? And I don't know if this is making any sense whatsoever, but, you know, it's just the fact that, like, you know, it's good that everything kind of sucks now because you... get to, you feel privileged to know that it didn't used to be that way.
That is true.
You know?
That is true, yeah.
And you also, it also gives you like a sense of kind of like comfort in the fact that like, you know, the things that I love could never ever be replicated again. So it's like, I don't have to worry about trying to do that, you know? And things like that. I don't know if that makes sense, but you know.
Yeah.
It's like doing a podcast where it's just me, a person you've never heard of, talking about things just into a microphone at night. It's not something at all that fits into the current zeitgeist of entertainment and what
right.
people want to hear. But that's also kind of comforting to me because I can sort of like just do it.
Yeah.
And not have to have any kind of gatekeeper that tells me I can't do it. And I can engage with the thing that I love. Without sort of having to like stress out over the fact of whether or not people are going to pay me to listen to it. So, you know. Anyway.
I really like the idea that someone might listen to it in the future after
yeah,
I'm dead.
Yeah, maybe I'm going to turn it off and what's going on.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to listen to this. It's going to use up all the space. I'm going to film more stuff later. So, anyway. But yeah, that was. Really B-roll.
Oh, that was just B-roll.
No,
yeah.
No, but I filmed it. It's like we could probably play some on the computer. Anyway. Yeah. Sorry, I feel like I've been kind of taking up the pizza in the conversation.
Well, there's plenty of pizza.
Yeah.
It's really good pizza.
It is, isn't it good? I know. Told you. Yeah, the other place I recommended, Slice.
Mm-hmm.
They started down near my house, and now they've got locations all over the place. Did it take you long to get here, by the way? Was it too much of a drive?
No, it was 25 minutes.
Okay, mine was about 15, so I'm sorry that I made you drive.
That's all right. I live out in the boonies.
Mm.
Kind of by choice.
Mm-hmm. Y'all look like we're... y'all like where you live and you made like a lot of
no.
contacts? People
know. Laura. You know, she...
Yeah?
She misses just the food and entertainment choices of Dallas-Fort Worth. It's hard not to, you know?
Well, there's a lot of places here in Alabama. It's like I told you on Sunday.
Yeah.
If you go downtown and kind of to the surrounding parts of the city, there's a lot of places to eat. Out that way, you're really just going to get like chain restaurants, you know, and things like that. So,
yeah.
It's like if you. There is a good food scene in Birmingham. You just actually have to be there to do it. So,
and,
yeah.
I guess it's just, you know, kind of Pelham, Alabaster area.
Yeah.
It's just not a pretty city.
Yeah, I mean, it's sprawl, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, you know, that's the area where I went up. You know, I went to Pelham High School, and so I'm very familiar with that area. And if you're, like, an artistic, creative person, it's not the best place. I remember when I was a senior in high school, and I was driving with my friend, and I was sort of just, like, I had a little Hi8 camera with me, and I was just kind of, like, putting the camera and just, like, sort of filming, you know, just the day, just like I just did, and kind of filming the day, just driving around, and I remember this huge-ass diesel-run pickup truck next to us, and this shit-kicking redneck just looked out of the window and just said, "Why the fuck are you filming Pelham, Alabama? The place sucks."
Oh, boy.
And all that, and I got like that. It's like, it's funny because like everybody sort of films things now, so these days you wouldn't have thought twice about it. But like, it was just like that guy just looked at me and like saw me like holding the camera, and he thought that I was just like insane for wanting to actually document something a little bit, you know. And that's where I grew up. You know, it's like I grew up like that whole part of town is just very.
I kind of appreciated that aspect of growing up here.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Mobile, probably easier place for an artistic kid to grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, because most of the town, there's a bigger, well, you know, 60% of the town's Catholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, really.
Which,
I guess that makes sense, yeah.
Which and then there's the seafood aspect, and there's the salt line.
Yeah.
Meaning anytime you get anywhere and you can smell the salt air.
Yeah.
Culture is different.
Mm-hmm.
And Mobile kind of has that French heritage,
mm-hmm.
Spanish heritage, mm-hmm. and of course Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
And you know, a lot of people that aren't from there don't realize that those organizations, those people meet and interact with each other all year long.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Mardi Gras is the highlight of their season.
Right.
It's not the whole thing.
I don't think
thing.
I realized that until I saw that HBO show, Tremé. You know?
Oh, okay.
If you watch that show, Tremé, it gets really, really deep into that.
Oh,
that's true. It does. It just made me realize, like, oh, this is like a real cultural thing that just goes in on in perpetuity. And
like, we were off for school that
week.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, that was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so every year, you know, I would get to see administrators, principals of my school drunk off their ass, you know, at a nice hotel in downtown.
Right.
And all the friends are, you know, drinking and smoking pot, and the cops are all looking the other way.
Yeah.
Because it's Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's like that, I don't think that happened in the rest of Alabama. I don't think that type of culture was really.
That's not common, no.
Because the Catholics, ironically, are a very formal religion in some ways.
Yeah.
But they like to drink.
No, they that's why they have an entire holiday where they literally can just let it all go before they. And
Right.
Jessica was raised Catholic.
Oh, okay.
You know, so she did communion and all that stuff, and you know, that's very much the thing. It's just a very. It's like the Southern Baptists are interesting people, like the people I grew up around, because
mm-hmm.
you know they look at almost everything you do as a sin.
Uh-huh.
And they, but you do, I mean, you know, and so like they just, it's not like the Catholics where they sort of have like an actual protocol for sort of like atoning for the sins and everything like that. Southern Baptists have no freaking clue how you're supposed to do that. Mm. They're just basically like, you sin, just pray whenever you want to. You stay in line at the grocery store, just pray to God, you'll be okay.
Right.
And all that. And so it like has this like feeling of sort of like, it instilled in me like obsessive compulsive disorder. Yeah, that'd be great, man. Thank you. It instilled in me like obsessive compulsive disorder.
I can see it.
You know, where it's like I just was feeling bad about myself like all the time, you know? And so in order to do that, you kind of have to like pray five times. So I was basically like, I would have made a great Catholic. You know, I would have, honestly. But, like, the Southern Baptists are basically, like, not giving you any kind of, like, way to sort of work through your sin and your, you know, like, your guilt and all that.
Yeah.
They're basically just, like, if you feel bad about it, then you just need to pray about it whenever you want to.
It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like religion, base level religion itself, or base level... Here's my theory, Mike. Judaism, let's call that technology 1.0. Secret for how man became a civilized animal, how laws came to exist, basic rules for having a culture, get along. There, if you look at game theory, there's a type of situation where you don't forgive the other person, and once they turn on you, you only turn on them.
Okay.
Now, there's a smarter way to play where if you will test the waters every once in a while by forgiving your enemy, then you end up better off in the long run.
Okay.
Now, if they screw you again, you go back to screwing them, but then you forgive them again and you test the water.
Okay.
And that causes... that. See, that's the difference between isolated culture, where you're just with one small group of people, versus lots of cultures interacting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
So Christianity, in my way of thinking, is a technological refinement on Judaism.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking about any... there's no magic in what I'm talking about. I like kind of the Alan Watts interpretation of religion. And I've kind of like had kind of some of my own thoughts on top of that. Where if you think about it as being like, there's no magical, none of the magical stuff is needed at all. That's people and organizations applying a layer of BS over some rock solid advice.
Yes.
I just see it as a technology that man developed.
And a communication tool. You know, it's no different than, you know, dialectics, you know, being able to sort of like talk back and forth, work your way through like a question, you know, and all that. It's, you know, again, it's like when I got older, it's like I got to like middle school and everything, and like you no longer had really a model for how you were supposed to behave, because like Jesus was a baby and then he was an adult.
Right.
Well, how did he behave like during this time? Why does the Bible just cut all that out?
Right.
Like, how am I supposed to be like Jesus if I don't know what Jesus was like? You know.
And all the organized
when
religions.
When he was going through puberty, you know.
All the organized religions.
Yeah.
They make him out as this nice guy.
Yeah.
Who's not dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he was very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Well, in terms of being, you know, what they thought was like sort of, like a radical.
Yeah.
You know, and they,
because he kind of thought any organized group of people practicing religion was kind of full of themselves.
Yeah, and then he was like, come with me, I'll show you how to do it.
right. So it's ironic that you end up with all these groups.
Yeah.
It's kind of like he made the church unnecessary in a way. And then everybody said, well, let's build a church around him.
Yeah, I know. And it's basically, it's almost like teaching, where it's like, did I not? I'm going to go through this one more time. Okay? You don't have to do this.
Well, yeah.
So, you know,
I guess that is the upsetting thing about being a teacher.
Yeah. I'm not trying to bring it around to that. It's like I'm just going through that right now.
Not only do most people they're not gonna get it.
Yeah.
And then they don't want to get it either.
No.
Yeah, that's what would bother me. If I was reading some kid's paper, right?
Yeah.
And he wrote some bullshit that I could tell he didn't even try.
Yeah.
It just sort of pisses you off, probably.
It does piss you off because you spent so much time making sure that he got it.
Yeah.
And you spent so much time designing lesson plans to sort of, like, specifically make sure, like, you know, like, of how to get across to them what they're trying to do.
Yeah.
And then you sort of just, like, see what they do. You put in, like, hours of work, and they maybe put in 5 minutes, you know?
Yeah, right.
It really pisses you off. It really does. There's no way around it, you know? And I'm getting to the point right now where it's like the world is so bad.
Yeah.
That,
Don't let it get to you, man.
I'm trying not to, but
I can hear it in your podcast.
The world is just getting so... It's making everything that we do just feel so trivial.
But the media we consume does manipulate us.
I know it does, and that's 100% something I do.
Do we want a to-go box or anything?
Do you want to take any of that home with you?
Not for me, man. No, Laura actually ordered pizza tonight since I was going out and having pizza.
Wow.
So, right. My wife doesn't eat ham. She'd kill me if I brought that in here. So...
Oh, okay. Man. It was so good, though.
Yeah, it was.
That's all right. Good. Sorry, I'm
for there. Thank you for that.
Do you guys think you're ready for your cuts?
Yeah. Is it okay we split? Is that all right?
Yeah,
you don't get the whole thing. I'm splitting it. That's okay. I would pay for the whole thing.
No, I want to get it, man.
Okay, well,
let me get it.
Okay.
Yeah, just one.
Yeah, just one?
All right, thanks. Cut.
Yeah. If you change your mind later on, I guess. No, I'm good.
I'm good. Thank you, man. What did he say? Do we want dessert?
Do you want dessert? I don't know. I don't even know if they have dessert here.
That's a problem with not being able to hear.
I know.
People are always saying stuff to me, and I'm like, I don't know.
I'm going to get this is like the opening shot.
Oh, okay.
Of the vlog right here.
Oh, nice, yeah.
You know, so that's the hardest thing to do, like, because I've done, like, now.
Never have enough B-roll.
You can't. No. And I'm all about B-roll. No, I've done, like, thanks, man. I appreciate it. But I've done, like, 8 of these. This will be my 8th one that I've done in a row in, like, 7 weeks. The hard thing is coming up with new stuff to do every week. Because audio is one thing, but video is another. You know, so, it's like, you're sort of thinking about, like, how do I make this interesting? But, yeah, it's one of these things where it's, like, it is coming across in everything that I do.
Yeah.
But I've never, ever, ever been a political person and somebody that gets caught up in all of it. And you're right. The media 100% gives you meta narratives that you follow. But I have, in the last 4 weeks, really, really seen firsthand how this man is actually ruining lives.
Mm.
One of my colleagues today, like her husband, just got a Fulbright grant to go to Georgia, the country, and study something he's been working on for years to do. It's like kind of the crowning achievement of his academic career. Snatched away from him because of federal budget cuts and federal grants to educators. I mean, this man, I've been watching him sort of single-handedly. He's trying to dismantle arts. He's trying to install himself as somebody who is actually trying to control the way that, like, artistic and creativity is distributed and presented throughout this country. And he hates educators. He fucking hates us. And it pisses me off so much because nothing offends me more than just, like, you know, people honestly thinking that I get up every day excited to go in and indoctrinate children. Legitimately think, and I've been hearing this for years from parents.
Right.
But to hear, like, the president of your country sort of say that really just pisses me off. You know?
It does seem like a growing problem. Like, I mean, I gotta admit, I first started seeing it in 1989 when I started South Alabama.
Yeah.
There were professors that had a serious
bent. I know. I'll admit that.
And they were pushing, and it was more evident then because there were still some older professors left that were more academically minded, that believed in kind of a rich general appreciation of Western history.
Yeah.
And there was a pride about Western history that was still there.
Mm-hmm.
And while I understand the need to understand it's not the be-all, end-all, if you don't have a culture,
yeah,
you have no culture.
Well, and, yeah, you're and, exactly right. Yeah.
And so, on the one hand, yeah, to say everything's relative and a pile of shit in the middle of the room is just as artistic as Leonardo da Vinci, anything he ever drew or painted. Okay, I get it, right? I get the artistic statement. And, but the problem with it is that postmodernism and the Frankfurt School line of thought and their kind of support of Marxism, it paints itself as this salvation for the working class.
Yes, I know.
But the reality is that it's just oppression, and the working class just ends up enslaved.
I know. Well, here's the thing. My point of this is that we need to have some serious conversations right now about what the ultimate goal of like liberal arts education is.
Right, right.
We're not having the right conversations. When we're sort of saying like the academics are in the classroom to teach the students who are otherwise not susceptible, and let's just assume for a second that they literally cannot think for themselves.
Okay.
Let's just assume. So we're saying that the academics are in the classroom and now literally trying to impose these ideas, these postmodern meta narratives on kids, and saying that the whole world is based on a struggle for race, a struggle for power,
right?
That it's the rich against the poor and all that stuff. That is a problem when you have academics doing that. My thing is that at the very basic level of an education, is that we can't, most kids in who are going into higher learning right now can't even fucking write a sentence, and are not even in the position to be able to actually listen to their teachers. The conversation we need to be having right now is it really a good idea?
There you go.
Thank you.
No problem. You guys have a good night.
Thanks.
You too.
But the conversation we really need to be having right now is it a good idea to just get all of these hundreds of thousands of 18-year-olds every single year who lived at their house, their parents' house, their whole lives,
right,
spent the last 4 years basically like being on their phone,
yeah,
and doing the same exact writing over and over again?
Right.
Is it a good idea to sort of tell them, yes, you can come and live on your own on a campus, and you can be on your own, your parents cannot help you? Is it a really good idea to do that? Because what I'm seeing right now is that it's not.
Hmm.
Is that these kids are kind of coming into the classroom completely unprepared for the idea that they're working, they're having to actually balance their own personal lives with a professional or academic life. I've had so many students actually this semester alone drop out of my class. I just got an email from a student today who said, I'm dealing with mental health issues right now. You know, I'm having a hard time making money and also coming to class. And I wanted to tell her, that's not a mental health struggle, that's a life struggle. You are dealing, that's a life thing. That's life.
Right.
The thing is like, we need to sort of seriously have this conversation right now of like, what kind of kids do we actually want going into the workforce? My thinking is like, take education.
Yeah.
Because the best students that I have are the non-traditional students. These are the ones who are like in their mid-20s.
Yeah.
Older. Who come back, have been out in the world.
Oh,
for
I can
a while.
Totally believe that, yeah.
So, my thing is, do this. You're 18 years old, you're getting out of high school. If you are not wanting to immediately go into college and know exactly what you want to do, then we will give you, it will be government subsidized, 2 years, go and work in a service job.
Yeah.
Because right now, places like this cannot get employees, they can't get enough employees. Go and work in a service job for 2 years.
Yeah.
Take that paycheck every week and put part of it toward a savings account that accrues interest for college.
Right.
At the end of that 2 years, okay, you will be able to find out, figure out if you want to continue working on that job or if you now want to go to college.
Right.
And now, if you decide that you want to go to college, you can take that money, that savings, and you can put it toward tuition. And colleges, because they're saving a lot of money every year on educating less students, will now be able to actually offer you rebates to come into, like, tuition breaks to come in. So it will basically almost get college tuition cost evened out a little bit to where it used to be like 30 years ago.
Yeah.
And it'll give students a better idea of actually what they want to go into college to do. Because the situation I'm facing right now, especially this semester, I've got out of 90 students this semester, I've got 20 who have completely dropped off the face of the earth.
Oh my gosh.
Like, who
That's
have
a big percentage.
Yes, it is. Who have completely not turned in any work, not come to class, been absent. And I talked to my supervisor, and I was like, what is going on here? And she's like, this just happens every spring. It just gets to be too much for students. And it's like, wait a second. the college gets to be too much. Like, they can't.
Right.
They're freshmen.
Yeah, like, it's the easiest time of their lives.
I mean, what? And I couldn't believe it. This it's like, well, if this is just something we expect, we need to kind of change that, don't we?
Somehow, culturally, we've raised a generation that's really not capable of much.
I know, and the weird thing is like,
and I hate to say that, but
they become capable eventually. Like, eventually, a thousand monkeys at a typewriter would churn out a decent human being, you know. And but I am seriously worried about, like, my students and, like, their ability to actually process information, and just because
I think we're going to find that the algorithm of social media is very destructive.
Oh, it's already. Yeah, I think we've.
And we're probably going to have to put limits on it until you're 20 or something.
Well, yeah. And I think, obviously, that we do need to think about social media as being a true addiction. And, like, any other substance that causes addiction, we do need to put, like, an age limit on it. Like, you need to be 18 before you can have a TikTok.
It might be just as simple as the dopamine reward, stimulus reward cycle that it hijacks in, you know, a young person.
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
It does. You know, I mean, again, Jonathan Haidt, you know, put out these two books over the last few years, The Anxious Generation and The Coddling of the American Mind. It talks about all of this.
Check that out.
You know, in 2010 is what he said. 2013. No, it was 2008.
When the iPhone became ubiquitous.
That was the inflection point.
Everyone was handed an iPhone at age 10.
After 2010, you see mental health crises go up. You see teenage suicides go up.
Right.
You see grades go down.
And there were organizations with questionable motives on all sides of the political spectrum. Really taking advantage of programming these children to be victims, or to believe they were victims, and it's really kind of destroyed all so much progress we made in race and sex relations.
Yes, it is. And that is the thing. It's like, I was walking around campus tonight, and I was like, I've gotten so many emails from students over the past 3 weeks, specifically while they've been doing this project, that use the word mental health, my mental health, my mental health, my mental health. You go all over campus, and it's all over the place. Mental health help. Mental health crisis. Counseling.
Right.
They're putting it in front of them all the time. And it's like, you know, when you advertise a problem, people are going to know that think that they have that problem. It's the restless leg
syndrome. It's not that concentrating and making yourself read and making yourself sit and write something is hard.
Yeah.
It's that you're having a mental health crisis because Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Like, I'm definitely having a mental health crisis, but I can sort of, like, attribute it to something. It's not just me. You know, it's like, it's just, I typically have a mental health crisis when I'm stressed out and anxious over something I can't control. That's why I'm not a sports fan.
That's why I don't watch sports, you know? Because I can't control that outcome, you know? And right now...
Oh, gosh, yeah, I know.
You know, we are all... Anybody who didn't vote for that fucking guy, we're all... None of us are in control of anything that's going on right now. You know? And so...
Of course, on the other hand, yeah. I mean, we survived whoever was running the country before.
Yeah, we did.
Like the gang... Who was running the country? We don't know.
Well, if you...
Obama?
If you want to get into Frank's whole thing, and we can talk about that, definitely. Where it's like
no,
this,
I mean,
because you know,
obviously yeah. It wasn't Biden.
Yeah.
And it was not going to be Kamala.
No. What it is like what we saw, I think, it was very clear during the...
There was the cabal of people behind
the
scenes.
Yeah, what was very
running.
Clear during the 2016 election is that the people wanted Bernie Sanders to be the nominee.
Right.
And they made it Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And that's why we fucking have Trump. Because, yeah. Like, we...
That was the last Democrat I was for. I was for Bernie.
Yeah.
Until they did that.
People are still for Bernie Sanders. I mean, right. You know, he's the only one in the Senate right now who is saying to Republicans, do not... You, I will not listen to you, and you until you tell this guy that was your boss... That Ukraine did not start this war. Like, I'm not going to listen to anything you say.
Oh, I believe they did. I believe Ukraine started it.
Okay, well,
not,
we don't have to get into that.
Not Ukraine.
Okay. Okay.
I believe NATO
okay.
and the United States started this war.
Yeah.
Because, for the same reason, mm-hmm. I believe we started the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Okay.
The Cuban Missile Crisis, yeah. We were all taught in school
mm-hmm.
that the Soviets dared to put nuclear missiles on Cuba
yeah.
and how evil they were.
Yeah, yeah.
It leaves out the fact that months before,
mm-hmm.
we put nuclear missiles on their border
mm-hmm.
in Turkey, I think,
okay.
somewhere like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
They said, if you don't take your missiles away, we're going to have a problem.
Okay.
We said, fuck you.
Yeah.
And the reason we said fuck you
mm-hmm.
is that the United States, since... past World War II, has been running on simulations derived by the RAND Corporation,
yeah.
the Council of Foreign Relations, and other think tanks who came up, they game theoried it all out, and they determined that our best policy was, regardless of what happened, to tell Russia, fuck you.
Mm-hmm.
So we promised Russia after they dissolved, and they came to the U.S. and they tried to become a member of the world community.
Right.
We said, fuck you,
mm-hmm.
1990.
Mm-hmm.
They went through a horrible economic downfall.
Mm-hmm.
They elected Putin. They mm-hmm. helped. They got their shit together. They're doing
right.
pretty good.
Yeah.
So we then said, well, we will never advance NATO closer to your border
yeah.
than we are now. But then the CIA fueled a coup
mm-hmm.
in Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
put Zelensky in charge,
mm-hmm.
went out into the... Russian countryside of Ukraine, because
mm-hmm.
that whole half of the country that Russia has since taken back over is predominantly,
yeah.
dominantly Russian.
Yeah.
They started oppressing those people horribly.
Mm-hmm.
So the West, because we were so wanting to fuck Russia,
mm-hmm.
we told them, screw you, we're going to let Ukraine into NATO.
Mm-hmm.
Russia said, are you fucking insane?
Mm-hmm.
We will go to the mat on this.
Yeah.
We will, no joke, go to nuclear war over this.
Yeah.
We don't care.
Yeah.
The U.S. said, no, you won't.
Mm-hmm.
We started giving them hundreds of millions of dollars a year
mm-hmm.
to build an army of 500,000
mm-hmm.
incredible soldiers.
Yeah.
Packed to the brim with NATO technology.
Yeah.
And we said, we're going to go to war with Russia,
mm-hmm.
but we're going to do it through Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to lose a single soldier.
Yeah.
America's going to benefit because all our defense industries are going to get billions and billions
yeah.
of dollars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So at this point in American history, somehow
mm-hmm.
the liberal side of our
mm-hmm.
people
yeah.
supported the military-industrial complex's goal of bringing money to America by... a proxy war where we were going to spend the youth of Ukraine and we've killed like over a million
yeah.
Ukrainians have died.
Okay.
Russia hasn't lost but about 100,000 soldiers
okay.
in reality.
Yeah. I have absolutely no doubt in my mind whatsoever that like the United States is like, you know, using other countries as proxies. I absolutely believe that. Of course I do.
Yeah.
I do say though at the same time though that Ukraine, no matter what kind of responsibility they bared in it at first, they were the middleman, they were a proxy.
Yeah.
And it, and when Trump says that they started it, Trump also then, going by what you just told me, has to admit the United States' culpability in the whole thing.
Oh, that's the truth of it.
So he's leaving them out to dry. He's saying that they started it alone. And that's what's a lie. That's
they agreed to it, and NATO agreed to it.
I mean,
they agreed to it, and NATO agreed to it.
Yeah, but
and NATO, Europe is still all behind this.
Yeah,
Europe, 100% wants the United States to pay for every single Ukrainian to die, so Europe doesn't have to fight a war against Russia.
Yeah.
Ukraine's gone. There is nothing left. We were legitimately risking World War III.
Yeah. I know. I think,
like, I don't think we've ever been closer to World War III than we were when whoever was running the country before this last election was still all in.
Yeah. No, you absolutely make, I mean, like, everything you're saying to me, like, is absolutely, like, I 100% am not downing you whatsoever. That whatever happens in this world is, there's one superpower behind it. Right, there's some superpower that's kind of controlling the entire thing, the entire narrative, the way that money goes and everything like that. You know, I totally 100% get you. And you know, but I'm just saying, like, what is going on right now, the narrative that's being spun out by this administration, and to a large degree obviously the news, is the fact that it is a single thing. It's so black and white, you know?
Right.
There's Ukraine and Russia, but we also sort of bear a lot of responsibility in it. You're absolutely right.
I don't think they're ever going to admit that.
You know? Yeah. But...
Because I don't...
Yeah. These are the deeper narratives that we can talk about, because we can actually sort of look at them. We are really getting to see firsthand how chaotic the world really is. And whenever you sort of have, like, that kind of chaos, you always have a very small group of men come in and try to order it and reshape it in their image. You know? It's always happened.
Yeah.
And we're going through this right now.
And it's never a good thing.
No, it's not. Of course not. But, you know. but, you know, it's just, you know, what really worries me right now is, like, I challenge you to name me another time in, like, our history where we have had such a descaling of ideology, where it's like we have three branches of government that are all on the same side. I can't think of another time in history than that. Maybe I'm wrong, but I can't think of that, where it's like the Supreme Court, the legislature, and the executive were all hardcore one way. Supreme Court is somehow the most neutral. I don't know. You know, even though there's, like, what, six justices that, you know, are on there now that were confirmed by Trump or, like, are hardcore Republicans.
Yeah.
You know, and
foreign. But, so, I mean, are they really leftists, or are they just constitutionalists?
Are they really
They've
defied Trump on several things, so it's like, I think that they are, they're still, like...
I think they're closer to constitutionalists.
They may be, but I think that there's still some decorum on the court now, where they realize
that there's
not
a big part of the left
ideological
that,
puppets,
that
you know?
No longer supports free speech.
Yeah.
And they do not understand how dangerous that is.
There is a huge...
They really don't understand how dangerous that is.
There's a huge truth to two things. There's a huge truth to woke mind virus and Trump derangement syndrome.
Right.
I hate those terms so much.
Sure.
Because they black and white everything.
And nothing's ever black and white.
Yeah, exactly. There's definite truth to that. I will not deny it whatsoever.
I think a lot of...
You know,
like...
Yeah.
I think a lot of people started to worry that that they were being lied to, that were longtime, lifetime, faithful, liberal-minded people who spent their whole lives trusting the Washington Post, trusting the New York Times, and they were full-on with this Trump's a Russian asset business.
Yeah, I know.
They never admitted that that was paid for by Hillary Clinton's campaign. They never admitted in the crucial months leading up to the 2020 election, the entire U.S. media was saying that Hunter's laptop was a Russian psyop.
I know. I know.
They legitimately threw a U.S. election, and they will not admit that.
The most recent one?
The 2020 one. They will not admit that they stole 2020, and they cannot bring themselves to admit that.
Yeah.
And I know that's controversial, but if you think about the entire media machine that we've now found out through Elon Musk was getting money directly from USAID.
I don't know. Like, I can cross some bridges with you, you know, if I sort of had the information right there in front of me, maybe. But,
like,
I do think, though, at the end of the day, you do, I mean, like, I can only sort of go based on, like, what actually happened, okay? And all the mechanisms that led to that happening, what was going on behind the scenes, the shadow stuff, I don't have the facts off the top of my head, so I'm talking about that, right? The chicken plants that are all staffed by immigrant labor, the schools around that neighborhood, the trailer parks where they live were flushed out. They were like ghost towns, you know, because people were genuinely like afraid. And I have a student whose stepbrother got deported.
You told me about that, yeah. And he was the one making money to support the family.
I mean, you know, it just was like, and I don't know all the situations about that, but I'm going to guess, based on contextually what's happening, is that he probably did get either caught up in an ICE raid, or maybe he didn't really get deported, but he just left voluntarily, you know, to sort of avoid it. I don't know.
Right.
But, yeah, anyway, so, you know, it's like everything that's going on right now, it's like I 100% agree there are things that we don't know, and there's also a lot of history that we probably do know, but the evidence is so disparate because it's not reported on by the media, by the news that we watch every morning. I don't know. I do go by Occam's razor sometimes. You just have to look at the guy, and you have to look at some of the things that he's doing. You know, just thousands of people laid off, losing everything that they work for, losing scholarships, losing grants, you know, like UAB losing $70 million of research money. I mean, that shit right there is real, and I don't really know how you can spin that to sort of say that there's some kind of master plan to it. They don't know what they're doing, and I mean, that's what troubles me.
Yeah, no, you know? The government probably was bloated.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, it's always bloated. I mean, nothing is ever efficient.
If you were going to fix such a thing, it would be smarter to drive it like you drive a battleship.
Yeah.
And you turn a little bit. You don't do a 90-degree turn. You start as people start retiring. You don't replace them, maybe. You know, but then I'm sure they're probably thinking, oh, we've only got 2 years to do stuff, so let's get it done quick. But that's not good for the economy.
No, it's not. Well,
because
my biggest thing is, like, how are you going to take 70,000 people who you just fired and, one, pay severance, two, even if you're not going to pay them severance, even if that's not part of the deal, how are you going to support them? Because, like, now they're all on unemployment. Even if they're probationary employees and they haven't racked up any kind of employment, where are they going to work? What are they supposed to do? Do you understand that most of these people work in, like, major metropolitan areas?
Right.
Where poverty and crime are already a huge threat?
Right.
Like, I mean, what... And not only that, but... I mean,
I'm very sensitive to that because I think about... I mean, I can't imagine how horrible it would be to just be out of work suddenly.
No, it's scary. And, like, to know that you didn't do anything at all. Imagine also the fact that these people are now going onto the job market with a block on their resume that they were fired.
I think everybody knows.
I think they do, too. But still, it is there, you know? It's sort of like, you know... Like, imagine if you're kind of trying...
Even a hardcore Republican, I think, hiring them would say, look, man, I know that wasn't your fault.
However,
at all.
Wait a second now. If we're talking about the guys down at the cigar store that I don't go to anymore because I can't be around them anymore, these...
You've kicked cigars because of...
Yeah, kind of. I don't go to the cigar store anymore because I can't be around them. They're nice guys, but these are guys who have... who are retired, who have made their money.
Right.
Some of them own businesses, and they love this guy still. Imagine you go and you apply to work with one of these fucking guys.
Oh, yeah.
Who don't care.
Right.
That's an issue. I'm not saying, I'm not saying I have any evidence of saying that that's going to happen, but you are right. Everybody knows, but also if you look at Trump's approval rating, a lot of people also don't know. You know, so, I mean, that's something to consider. So, anyway, I've never been, a heavily political person. I've paid attention, but you are right. There is something, you're getting to this point now where it's, for the last 15 years, basically, almost my entire adult life, I have had so little faith in politics.
Yeah.
And the ability of these leaders to actually honor their fiduciary obligation to take care of jobs and to make sure that we're all living good lives. They're more interested in what we believe than how we live, you know? And that's not the way to run a country. I mean, that's not what we're supposed to be doing here.
How did they all make so much money on a small government salary? That's disturbing.
Yes, it is, of course. Well, because a lot of them, when they get to that point, they get put on boards.
Right.
They get salaried.
Because they've got influence. They know
they
people.
They go to speaking engagements. And also Nancy Pelosi and her husband, get really, really rich off of the stock market, every day it opens.
Right.
Okay. So, you're right. It's I don't know these people. I don't know these people. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like when you grow up, you just sort of think that they know what they're doing, and then you get to you're like, they don't know what they're doing. They have no plan. They don't know. It's really just, just got to kind of do it for yourself, I suppose. I need to make a lot of money really quickly. and in a way, so I don't rely on the government anymore.
I feel the last 40 years or so of Republicans and Democrats and whoever in government all felt that the end was coming.
Yeah.
And that for that reason, they needed to make as much money as possible for themselves and their families because they all knew that the house of cards was going to fall.
Yeah.
Because even without everybody being unemployed, we still have a ridiculous debt.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, it's really not sustainable.
No, of course not. The thing is, they can sort of just print more or whatever they want. I mean, they really can. It's
but only until. Well, here's the other thing, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They thought that the ultimate damage to Russia would be to use the international banking system to remove them from the ability to commit commerce.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Well, unfortunately, Russia found a way around them and started their own currency.
Mm-hmm.
And it's now their currency is the size of Western currency on its own.
Yeah.
They literally don't need us anymore.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So if foreign countries, like the U.S. dollar being the international trade medium and being the official currency of oil because of the Bretton Woods Agreement made with the Saudi family a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the whole world trades in our money.
Yeah.
So we kind of had a free pass to print as much as we wanted because people were going to keep buying it and keep using it.
Mm-hmm.
But if anyone ever calls, the whole house of card kind of falls apart.
Yeah, no, yeah.
And what if Elon's right? Yeah, what if Fort Knox is empty? Because it really
be. They missed the best joke because they were showing that on John Oliver's show on HBO.
Yeah.
They were showing Trump on Air Force One. He was kind of talking about how we're going to go to Fort Knox. And there was a guy that was standing right behind him who looked like Oddjob from Goldfinger.
Yeah.
How did they not get that joke? He looked exactly like Donald
and they
Trump.
Didn't.
Donald Trump looks like Goldfinger, and he actually had a guy standing behind him who looks like Oddjob, and they missed that joke somehow. Because don't let a guy, like we know from James Bond movies, don't let a guy that looks like that next to a guy who looks like that around your gold.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't fully get why it even matters because our debt's so high
that
it's almost like so what if there was gold in Fort Knox? It's not going to fix the
debt
problem.
Yeah, no, it doesn't matter. It's like, it's just like...
It's playing on people's emotions, I think.
It feels so imaginary. Exactly. Well, when you look at the debt clock, you know, in Times Square, wherever the hell it is, you know, it's like, what does that even mean? I don't know what those numbers mean. It looks like algorithm for Facebook. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's like the fact that it keeps going up doesn't change my mind one way or the other. It's like I care about paying off my debt, my credit cards.
Yeah.
I know that that affects me somehow, but I have no way of knowing, you know. And,
well, it does affect us all, you know? In that, you know, inflation is a tax.
Yeah, yeah.
Inflation is an invisible tax.
Yeah.
So, like, I mean, if you've got, you know, if you've got money in the bank or investments, and inflation's gone up 20-something percent over the last couple of years, well, it doesn't matter that your investments have gone up 20% because inflation's now made that money worth 20% less.
I know, and I relate to that and all that. Like, I mean, I went through that. It's like, with retirement and all that stuff and my savings. You know, the thing about it is, it's just like, it's not like it's irrelevant to me. It's just like sort of, it's not doing anything to assuage my... You know, to assuage my peace or my anxiety or whatever like that. It's just sort of like, I can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
I can worry about it.
If you worry about it, though,
you know,
you're expending energy today for a problem that may not exist tomorrow.
That's what I'm talking about. I know. It's like,
it's very bad.
Debt and money and all that stuff.
Have you listened to Alan Watts?
No, I
haven't.
No.
Do you know who he is?
No.
He was like this kind of hippie guru guy in the before the hippies, kind of the start of the Beat Generation through the early hippies.
Yeah.
He's the guy that brought Eastern Buddhism and meditation and religion and all that kind of whole scene came in through the beatniks and the early hippies through Alan Watts.
Yeah, okay.
So he was kind of their guru. And luckily all his lectures are online.
Oh, man.
All over the place.
Yeah.
And imagine like the most brilliant, religious philosopher you've ever thought about, who not only understands one religion but understands dozens of them and how they relate. And he took a lot of LSD and somehow he had the linguistic skills to distill it all into a single narrative and spit it out at you. And you listen to him and you go, oh my God, a lot of those thoughts have been on the periphery of my consciousness and I've never been able to link them together in a straight line. But you just did it. That's what listening to Alan Watts is like.
Great.
And his talks about worry and anxiety, I think would really help because I could listen to your podcast recently and I could tell the anxiety about things is like, I was like, oh man, I wish Mike wasn't so anxious about that. Mm. And then I could also...
A lot of it's kind of played up, by the way. It's like what I try to do with it is I sort of like take everything that I've been worried about for the week, and I mean the last couple of episodes especially have been very, very well, like very constructed.
Oh, okay.
Because I don't want to do a show where I'm just like sort of ranting and everything with no point. Everything I say, I try to sort of like a lot of it is to a degree like a character. So don't worry about it. It's like it's fine, and I think like this dinner, it's like you've really seen a lot of my anxiety that's kind of unleashed. You know,
I think a lot of people that grow up in any religious context, unfortunately, like if I had friends that grew up Catholics and it really did a number on them in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
The ones that really, you know, were heavy and it was a kid and believed it as a kid. And then the same thing, I know the whole Southern Baptist thing can really do a number.
Yeah.
On
just growing up, any kind of religion or whatever. Yeah,
right.
Really
just
hurt.
Any organized religion can.
Because you are designed to sort of like worry about things that you can't control.
Yeah.
You know, and
but
also,
Alan Watts
also told that there's consequences if you do bad things. You know.
I think Alan Watts can help a person see the bigger picture behind it.
Yeah.
and maybe alleviate some worry and,
yeah,
and realize how it's there's nothing yeah. new happening.
Yeah.
It's the same old story, and it just we can't even stop it from happening.
Yeah,
it's just gonna keep happening.
No,
like
I know
this.
Exactly. Yeah, everything is just sort of like cyclical and.
You and know, it's like a wild pendulum
yeah.
that spins into chaos.
I was taking a little bit of solace in the fact that in the last couple of days, it almost kind of starts to feel like maybe Trump and Musk are realizing that this is not sustainable to just wake up every day and just, you know, put people out of work and make all these executive orders. And it's like maybe... Yeah. Not sustainable, and so when Musk started talking about the $5,000 checks and everything, I was like, okay, so I feel like he thinks that the approval rating should be higher, and it's not, so he's starting to walk back some things, and I think I
don't want a $5,000 check. I really don't. I'd rather they keep these people employed.
Well, the thing, yeah, exactly.
And not give me a $5,000 check.
Okay, that $5,000 is going to pay my rent for the next month.
The inflation that's going to happen by giving everyone $5,000 is going to take much more than $5,000 out of my.
I don't think it's going to happen at all. But at least I'm sort of seeing like they seem to be desperate already.
Mm.
They realize, I think, that it's not sustainable. But I think they think about it only in a very small way. The way that I'm thinking right now, that I got to stop at the store on my way home and get some milk.
Ah.
You know?
I hope he still helps us become a multi-planetary species.
Yeah.
And, you know...
I'd like us to do a lot more things before he gets there, you know?
I mean, that... That alone would be, in the long run, not in my lifetime, but in the long run would be better for humanity than any temporary economic conditions. It's just that if we don't become multiplanetary, then because time is so fleeting and so quick, it's like, what's the point of any of it? But then I think I haven't any kids. And I'm not going to have any kids, so what's my skin in the game? What do I care if we become multiplanetary and survive as a species or not?
Well, you don't have to. I mean,
I guess my genes live on through like my nephew and niece.
I'm getting to the point right now.
To some degree.
Well, the last 3 weeks have gotten me to the point where it's like, I don't really give a shit about this species, honestly. it's like... If the end result of this, it's like, you know, you can go into the forest, you can look at a million beautiful trees, right?
Yeah.
But then you can look at, like, one freaking ugly venomous snake that would kill you in 5 seconds.
Right.
And you're like, I don't want any of that if I have to deal with that, you know?
Right.
It's one of those things where it's like, I mean, we've kind of proven that, like, this whole experiment may very well end. Because we've proven that we just, like, there's nothing, like, we have settled for this guy. We are now totally okay with, like, the vice chairwoman of Worldwide Wrestling to run our Department of Education.
Oh, God, is that who?
You know, that movie Idiocracy that Mike Judge made.
No kidding.
He got a lot of things right in that movie. The one thing he got wrong, that it was going to take us 500 years to get there. I had no idea it was going to happen in this lifetime where we would literally have a wrestler, a professional wrestler as the president.
Yeah.
We got to get going.
Okay. The scene that really sticks out to me is the guy that goes, welcome to Megalo Mart,
I love you.
Because it's such a...
Yeah,
it's the kind of thing they get people to say that doesn't really have any meaning behind it.
It's corporations. Well, it's the same thing where you go into Welcome to Moe's. Welcome to Moe's. It's like, they don't mean that, really.
Oh, hey. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Get home safe, okay?
Oh, you too.
Here, I got to show you a couple things. We'll walk around and some stuff. I think
man, look at that, Mike.
What?
There's a world under there.
Oh, yeah. Whole underground world.